I'd like to take a few minutes at this time to introduce Brother Hawkins to you and share some things concerning his background. Alan J. Hawkins is a professor of family life at BYU. He earned his PhD in human development and family studies at Pennsylvania State University. Professor Hawkins has taught and conducted research and outreach at BYU since 1990. He recently received BYU's prestigious Carl G. Mazur Research Award. Brother Hawkins was a visiting scholar with the Administration for Children and Families in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, working on the Federal Healthy Marriage Initiative. He has also served as the Research Director of the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center and the Chair of the Utah Marriage Commission. Currently, he serves as a member of the Research Advisory Group of the Oklahoma Healthy Marriage Initiative. Brother Hawkins' scholarship and outreach focuses on education and policy interventions to help couples form and sustain healthy relationships and enduring marriages. He's widely cited for his work that examines the overall effectiveness and marriage of marriage and relationship education. And Brother Hawkins, we're grateful to have you with us today and look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Broderick. Good afternoon. It's really been delightful for me to be here, to see this. I was here 20 years ago, and campus has changed a little bit. Absolutely gorgeous, and such a beautiful day. Thanks for coming in on such a beautiful day to listen to what I hope will be a stimulating few minutes this afternoon. But thank you for the invitation. I'd like to begin my presentation here with a story, and this is a true story. A couple entered the Oklahoma City Family Expectations Program in a rapidly declining relationship. The couple mentioned to both their family support coordinator and their marriage educators that they were currently together because of their expected baby, and that the Family Expectations Program was their last hope of finding a way to make their relationship work. The couple later attended a booster session 3 months after the beginning of the workshop. At the session, they introduced their new child and announced that they were getting married. They reminded the class that they did not expect to stay together when they entered the program, but they credited Family Expectations for providing them with a solid foundation on which to build their strong relationship. At the heart of the couple's participation in this Family Expectations program, the father, at the start of that program, the father was opposed to marriage and viewed it only as a piece of paper. He attributed this belief largely to the failure of both his parents' marriage and the marriage of his partner's parents. After completing their workshop group and meeting with their family support coordinator, this man came to the realization that marriage is a commitment to the relationship and family and is integral to establishing a healthy support system for children. The couple was married in April, although this was actually written a few years ago, so it's not this past April. And that's a true story. It's a heartwarming, inspiring anecdote, but I open with it here, not for those reasons, but because it is a noteworthy public accomplishment. This couple was helped by a free educational program that is supported by significant government funding, your tax dollars and mine. And I'm going to be talking about some of those kinds of efforts today. Now, I don't know the end of the story. They still had significant odds in front of them. This less educated, lower income family that began in a non-traditional way, they have a lot ahead of them. But the program they participated in was designed to help interested couples form and sustain healthy relationships and enduring marriages so that more children in our society can grow up outside of poverty in a caring, stable family with both a mom and a dad. So my purpose today is to advocate for a feasible, strategic policy agenda to strengthen the institution of marriage. I don't have time to go through all the problems and challenges that we're facing. Let me make one clarification before I get going, however. Usually when we talk about these days public policy and strengthening marriage, we're talking about same-sex marriage. Our thoughts are drawn to that directly. And there's reasons for that. I mean, within the next week, we are expecting the U.S. Supreme Court to announce their decisions on the California Proposition 8 case, and also on the constitutionality of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and by extension, state Defense of Marriage Acts. About, 38 states have, or 30 plus states have state statutes also defining the institution of marriage as between a man and a woman. So the U.S. Supreme Court's going to weigh in on this within the next week. I was actually half expecting that, I haven't been tuned into the news today. Anybody know any different? Did the Supreme Court announce their decision this morning? All right. So we're still waiting. It's usually on the last day, a controversial case like that, and I think their last day in session is next Thursday, so that's probably when they will announce it. I'm not going to focus on that issue today. Regardless of what the Supreme Court says now, the legal issues are still going to be there. It's going to be in the courts for some time yet. It's not going to be settled. And there is still a crucial need for us as a society to help couples form and sustain healthy marriages, not just for the personal value that we have from a healthy marriage, but because of the societal value, because so many of the social problems that we experience have at their roots family instability. And I believe that family instability is our most significant social problem these days. And so I'm going to focus on helping the other 98% form and sustain healthy relationships and enduring marriages. The debate about same-sex marriage is an important one, and it will go on, but that is not my focus today. So just to quickly preview where I'm heading. First of all, I just very briefly want to set the stage with the problem, the negative effects of family instability. And then, given that, although this is a forum address, I do want to set a spiritual context for what I'll be talking about here this afternoon. I want to give you an idea of what I'm talking about when I talk about the Federal Healthy Marriage Initiative or State Healthy Marriage Initiative, public policy agendas that are out there trying to strengthen marriage. Because I've learned over time that very few people have any sense of what is being done or that anything is being done to strengthen marriage. And then I will, in very brief terms, tell you what I think we ought to be doing, or at least one a policy agenda that I think can make a positive difference. And I do hope I save enough time at the end then to talk about the concerns that people have about these sorts of things that I'll be talking about, their objections, their critiques, and then I'm going to subject you to my responses to those. This won't be interactive, I'm sorry to say, but I'm going to let you know what I think about some of those concerns. So that's where we're going. So here's the problem in a very, very tiny, condensed, dense nutshell. We have high rates of family instability. Now, we often think about that in terms of the divorce rate, and that is certainly part of it. We have continuing high divorce rates, about 40 to 45% of first marriages, 60% plus of second marriages do end in divorce. And 1 million children a year experience the divorce of their parents. Although let's point out that when we say the divorce rate, we have a very, papering over some very significant differences. For people like you, highly educated, religious, Your divorce rates have actually been going down substantially. Not yours personally, your group's divorce rates have been going down substantially over the last 30 years. You actually have a lower divorce rate in your age group than your parents did. But among those less educated in our society, and among the poor, those who are at higher risk for forming and sustaining healthy marriages, their divorce rates have continued to go up. Not dramatically, but have continued to go up and are now well over, well north of 50%. And so family instability does come from divorce, but these days we talk even more about the family instability that comes from high rates of unwed childbearing. In the United States, 40% of, a little more than 40% of children now are born to unwed parents. 50% of first birth children are to unwed parents, 50% of births to women under the age of 30 are unwed. And before the end of this decade, it looks very likely that more than 50% of all births, of all children born in the United States will be born to unwed parents. Now, it's not like these children don't start out in a family. Most of these children have two parents when they're born. They're not wed, but they are together. They have high hopes for their relationship. They want their relationship to work it out. They're trying to make that relationship work out. The reality, unfortunately, is that they experience very high dissolution rates. 5 years after the birth of that child to unwed parents, only about 20% will be together. Many of them in that first year or two and so they would not have many memories of being in a two-parent family. High dissolution risk and high risk of father absence from that child's life as a result of starting life in this circumstance. And these have very significant effects on children's development. You name it, and those children are at higher risk for that problem. And that has been well documented over a considerable amount of time by researchers. But we're not just, that and enough is a serious problem. But when it comes down to public policy considerations, it's kind of where's the money is what they ask. And what we know is that these problems have significant financial costs. One economist estimated the annual cost of family dissolution to be $112 billion a year. That's about what we were paying for the Iraq War a few years back each year. And by the way, there were a number of costs that he was not able to factor in. He couldn't really pin them down. So my best guess is that he's grossly underestimated the cost. If you want to bring that a little bit closer to home, he estimated the cost in Idaho per year to be about $127 million that we are paying in public tax dollars going to support those individuals who fall into poverty or experience other difficult problems that the government helps to pick up the pieces for. So it's an expensive problem, and indeed, that's usually when government gets interested in helping, is because they're paying for a lot of the problems that are there. Now, having set the stage in terms of the problems that we're trying to address, I want to back up just a little bit and make sure that, I draw strength from knowing that the prophets and the apostles are encouraging us to be involved in these kinds of efforts. You may remember a couple of conferences ago, Elder Oaks speaking out about protecting the children. And he starts this way, although I do not speak in terms of policies or politics or public policy. So he was making it clear that he's not advocating for any particular thing. And yet he says, I cannot speak for the welfare of children without implications for the choices being made by citizens, public officials, and workers in private organizations. We also need politicians, policymakers, and officials to increase their attention to what is best for children. And among that, he goes on to say, of utmost importance to the well-being of children is whether their parents were married, the nature and duration of the marriage. So I take some heart that the brethren are deeply concerned about our public policies and how they affect children in our society. We can also go back to the proclamation to the world on the family. And the last paragraph there, we call upon responsible citizens, that's you and me, and officers of government, that might be you, I don't think it'll be me, everywhere to promote those measures designed to maintain and strengthen the family as the fundamental unit of society. So I'm going to use this time to talk to you about what my policy agenda would be. I'm going to claim it is mine and not the brethren's. Please do not mistake me for that. This is not the church's endorsement of what I'm suggesting. But for me as a family scholar and one who cares about trying to help the children in our society, I think there are some steps that we could take that will help more children to grow up in a home with two loving parents. And I think that is an appropriate social goal for our society. Okay, I want to talk to you about the federal Healthy Marriage Initiative, and I'm going to talk to you about a couple of state initiatives. My guess, I won't ask for a raise of hands, but my guess is that less than 5% of you would have ever heard that such a thing existed out there. But there is this little experimental agenda going on that the federal government has been underwriting with our tax dollars over the past decade. They call it the Federal Healthy Marriage Initiative. Early on in the initiative, we weren't using the word healthy, and then people were complaining that, well, you're just talking about marriage even for marriage's sake and even preserving bad marriages. And so we started modifying that word with healthy. We're talking about trying to create and sustain healthy marriages. Well, how did the feds get interested? As I mentioned earlier today, talking to some students, about 20 years ago, the federal government discovered marriage. And the driving engine behind that was the fact that they were paying through their noses and with our tax dollars for all of the problems associated with family instability. A feeling that some of our welfare policies in trying to support poorer families were actually contributing to a weakening institution of marriage. And in 1996, it's hard to believe we're almost 20 years past this now, for me, we major reform of our welfare policies in the United States, emphasizing work and trying to emphasize stable families as the basis of our welfare policy. President Clinton said this was ending welfare as we know it. That may have been a little bit of an overstatement, but a significant change there. And at the very heart of welfare reform was acknowledging the goals of public policy was to help children grow up in stable two-parent families, to strengthen marriage, and to reduce out-of-wedlock births. Those were the goals legislatively stated for our new welfare policies. Some things began under President Clinton but picked up speed during the Bush administration. President Bush said that stable families should be the central goal of American welfare policy. So my administration will give unprecedented support to strengthening marriages. This is the first time that any government, the federal government, had made such a statement. It's not like they were opposed to marriage, but marriage was not something that they were directly targeting. And he said, that's going to change. Now, I'll let you in on a little secret here. President Bush didn't dream this up on his own or get it from the First Lady. He got it from his Assistant Secretary for Children and Families and within the federal government, a guy by the name of Wade Horn. Who started using that office that administers welfare policy in the United States and declared that strengthening marriage would be a high priority for that office and for his efforts. Well, How did he implement that policy agenda? What he did essentially was provide federal grants to community organizations that would offer educational services to help couples form and sustain healthy marriages. This was government support for community organizations, not government per se providing these educational services, but supporting community organizations that would provide some educational services, especially targeted to those more at risk for unhealthy relationships and relationship dissolution, less educated and lower income couples. And from 2006 through 2014, when our current grant program will end, the federal government will have invested close to $800 million in programs, educational programs, to help couples form and sustain healthy marriages. Now, for you policy folk out there, $800 million over that time period isn't even a rounding error in the federal budget. I mean, it's nothing. But to these people who are doing these programs who've never had this support before, these were very, very important in terms of getting these programs out to their communities, especially to the lower income communities who have not had much access to marriage and relationship education. And these are free services for them. I've got question marks there, probably one of the questions in your head. How many people have taken these programs? And I've been hounding the federal government for 2 years now, making a nuisance of myself to get that information. And they don't have it. They have it, but it's in file drawers and they're not compiling it. We've reached millions, but I don't know of how many we have reached specifically. We've reached a lot, and especially a lot more lower-income individuals with these kinds of services. By the way, Idaho is almost at the very bottom in terms of states that have had some of these funds. Not because I don't think it was because they were discriminated against. I only know of one organization in Idaho that applied for those funds in Nampa, and they received some funding. It's not funded anymore. But not much going on here in Idaho that way. So perhaps that's one reason why you have not heard much about it. And by the way, Idaho has the fifth highest divorce rate in the nation right now. So my sense is that you could use some things here. But there hasn't been a lot of work that has gone on here in the state that way. I was going to mention to you, you might be asking a rude question like, you know, do these programs work? Part of my scholarly agenda over the past several years has been trying to keep tabs on this and also producing some of the research that would evaluate whether or not these things are working. Now, I want you to know that most of these kinds of federal programs that get funded don't get evaluated. This is one initiative that from the very beginning, Wade Horde said, we're going to evaluate this. That's really quite unusual in federal terms. But there has been a good deal of evaluation research. It's a little bit mixed. Some suggested not working very well. Other studies suggesting some very positive results. Some of my own research suggesting that we really are having a small, but policy-wise, a noteworthy effect on just basic demographic statistics, on family structure, on child poverty, on the number of people who are marrying. We see small effects so far, which it's a small initiative, we wouldn't see large effects, but they are measurable and are making a difference and probably saving us money. So I'm encouraged, frankly, though there are other colleagues of mine who do not think the research is as strong as I do, but at least we are doing it. Now, having said that, I have some concerns about the Federal Healthy Marriage Initiative. For one, I'm worried that the leadership for this is waning. Now, the President Obama and his administration did continue this program at a lesser level in terms of funding, but it's still there, and are still doing some things. But I'm just reading the tea leaves out there, and I sense that there's less interest in this initiative. And indeed, they don't call it the Healthy Marriage Initiative anymore. They call it the Healthy Families Initiative. So there's just some little things like that that make me worried. But probably more important than that, I think this needs to be led state by state. I would like to see a more federalist experimentation process go on, where states are figuring out what will work best with in their state and for their unique needs. And we are experimenting with different approaches to trying to provide these educational services to couples out there to help them form and sustain healthy marriages. So I like that approach. I think that's where we need to be going. In addition, I think we've had kind of a scattershot approach at the federal level. We've had some money. We've asked organizations, hey, you want some money to help provide marriage education out there? Write us a proposal. They've looked at the proposal and said, this looks good. Not so sure about that. Would they fund this one? Not that one. And it's ended up being a kind of a scattershot approach, not very strategic. I think we can get more strategic, and I'll show you what I mean by that here in a moment. But essentially, we have been investing in a kind of vaccine notion of marriage education. Give them a one shot, give them 8 to 12 hours of good relationship education, and they'll be inoculated for life. They'll be able to avoid all their problems. I think that's a little bit optimistic. I think we need multiple dosages, starting young and at key time points along the way. And so I'll talk to you about that. I think we need to start young with what I would call relationship literacy education. Starting in probably the teenage years, probably delivered through school systems, to help them understand what a healthy relationship is and is not. You would be amazed at what people think about that. For instance, we know that about a third of dating relationships in high schools have violence in them, and they think that's normal. Just basic things like that we often don't know. And we often get to the, by the time people are ready to marry, they have so much baggage sometimes that it's hard to see how a marriage might work. We need to start young and invest in these kinds of services. Professor Gardner here on your campus has been involved in some of that research and trying to promote this kind of a thing. I commend him for that. But I think we need more. Not everyone's going to make all the best decisions. There will continue to be a high proportion of children born to unwed parents, but these are parents who want the relationship to work out. And the fact that I would have preferred that they would have figured that out before they had a baby doesn't matter. They want it to work. They want a family. They want the white picket fence. And I think we need to help them. And so I would call it relationship development education to help them gain the confidence that their relationship will work and the skills that they need to make it work so that they can join this noble and grand institution of marriage and have a higher likelihood of providing their children with that great birthright that they deserve. Then when they're ready to get married and when they've made that commitment, I think we can help them again. Now, a lot of you have heard about, marriage preparation education or premarital education. People have stars in their eyes, but they still need some help strengthening the foundations of that relationship, strengthening their communication skills, their problem-solving skills, aligning their expectations for marriage, and just getting off on the right foot. So I think support for that is needed. And then once we finally get them past the altar, I don't think we should abandon them. The second law of thermodynamics applies as much to human systems as it does to physical systems. Entropy exists in this world, and relationships fall apart if we don't keep working on them. And we can help with that, providing ways for couples to keep working on those things that they're not getting right or strengthening them for future problems and to keep that commitment strong. In addition, I do think that we need to be mindful of those who struggle in their marriages. That's most of us, by the way, but sometimes those relationships get on the brink. I don't have time to review the research on this, but there is a body of research, however, that suggests that many people who divorce are not making the best decision for themselves or for their children. Now, maybe I'm not surprising you by that, but there is a certain proportion of those who divorce who they're not solving their problems, they're probably making things more difficult for everyone involved, and that a better course for them would be to continue to try to work on their marriage, to repair it, and to keep the relationship and the family intact. And I think there are some things that we can do to help couples at the brink or at the crossroads of divorce to think more clearly about that most important decision. By the way, your most important decision in life is not who you will marry. The most important decision in life will be whether, and you'll make it many times probably if you're like most of us, is whether or not to stay married. And that can be a much harder decision. But we don't provide much help for that. And by the way, most people don't trust or go and seek out therapists to help them answer that question. I'm not commending it. I think therapists are good. I have lots of therapist friends, but most people don't go and get that kind of help. I think there are some educational services that we can provide that will help. I'm proposing that we accomplish this kind of agenda not with any new funding stream, which is going to be impossible over the next while. I mean, there just isn't going to be money for new things, I don't think. If it's not healthcare or defense, it's all going to get eaten up. But we already have the funding to do that. Every state in the United States receives a block grant from the federal government of funds to take care of needy families. It's called the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, what we used to call welfare. And that's millions and millions, in some states, billions of dollars to help needy families. There are guidelines from the federal government of how to use those funds, but a good deal of flexibility. What I am calling for is for every state to set aside just 1% for preventative educational programs to help couples form and sustain healthy marriages. Just 1% for prevention. You can use the other 99% for the ambulances at the bottom of the cliff rather than the fences at the top of the cliff. I also think it might be a good idea for us to think about our marriage license fees in a slightly different way. Instead of it being a fee that you give the government for their permission to be married, let's start thinking about it as an investment and take a portion of those marriage license fees that you pay and put them into efforts to strengthen marriage in our society, something that I can benefit from and my neighbors can benefit from. We start thinking about those funds as something that we invest in our marriages, not something that just goes to pay for the lights in a county clerk's office, although we do have to pay for lights for county clerks. In addition, I think the leadership should come from the state level and that the state agency that is administering these temporary assistance to needy families funds should provide that leadership. Although I think they would do best to have a very lean staff that does that and to rely on a voluntary board, advisory board of experts in the state to do that. And there are a few examples, or at least two examples, of states that are accomplishing something somewhat close to what I've been proposing. One of them is your state to the south here, south is Utah. That's invested about $10 million over the last 15 years in a statewide, state-directed effort to help strengthen marriage. Oklahoma is another one. I'll talk briefly about those. They've been spending a little bit more investing in Oklahoma. So in Utah, we think we've reached about 250,000 individuals with some kind of marriage and relationship education service there in the state. We have a class in our high schools, not required, but is an elective that some students take. We need more of them to do so, but a nice relationship literacy education class. We've been able to increase the proportion of individuals and couples in Utah who are investing in a marriage preparation experience over the since 2008, when we started really promoting some of that. And those numbers, I think, will eventually register in terms of a reduced number of distressed marriages and divorces. We also have legislated within the state a class that is required of divorcing parents. We call it divorce orientation. And it's not much, and it needs to be implemented better, but it's the state's way of talking to couples that are headed towards divorce and say, are you sure this is the right course for you? And to give them some resources if they want to check themselves and think about repairing the relationship. It does some other things as well, knowing that most will continue to divorce, but we try to reach them as well. And some research that I've done suggesting that our efforts have actually helped in terms of increasing the number of children born to two-parent families, to married families, and also has contributed to a reduction in children born to single-parent families. Those aren't exact opposites of each other, but so we've seen, we think we're moving the needle just a little bit. And I'd say that might, you know, we'd like to be doing a lot better, but even this minimal investment of effort and funds seems to be producing something valuable. Oklahoma, for just as a quirk of history, happens to be the state taking most seriously this effort to strengthen marriage. They've built a statewide infrastructure from the ground up to deliver these educational services to all sectors of society, churches, prisons, hospitals, schools, human service agencies, you name it, and they have injected into those systems marriage and relationship education classes for the state for free, using the most well-studied and perhaps the most effective curriculum that there is there. And then they adapt them to special needs and special circumstances. It's very impressive. And they have reached about 150,000 adults and 170,000 youth with these educational services there. And again, we seem to be seeing small impacts at the demographic level of these kinds of voluntary educational services there in Oklahoma. Again, they've funded these with temporary assistance to needy families programs and have expert advisory boards. This shows that what I'm proposing can be done and perhaps even is beginning to have the impact that we would like. Now, having done that, I'm going to save the last few minutes of my presentation. Thanks for your attention. To talk about objections to some of these things that we've been doing. There's always controversy about these kinds of policies, and this is no exception. I've kind of organized the critiques that I've heard over the last decade into four categories. And so I'll kind of take these category by category, tell you what the general nature of that critique is, and then I'm gonna give you my response to it, my defense, if you will, of these kinds of healthy marriage initiatives and the public support for them. So we'll begin with a first one. My suspicion is that in Idaho we would hear a lot of this. I hear a lot of it in Utah as well, but there's a number of libertarians here within the state of Idaho, and they would argue that romantic relationships are outside the purview of government and maybe even outside the skill, their ability to make any difference. Government ought to keep its nose out of such personal and private business. Well, first of all, my response to that, first of all, is this isn't big government. This is funding being used to support community initiatives delivered by United Way agencies, by schools, even by churches. They have to follow some pretty strict guidelines. They can't preach the gospel, but they can talk to people about how to have a happy relationship. So we're not talking about big government here. There's some question about whether the government can do anything, but to me, that's an empirical question, and I think we're getting there in showing that this kind of policy can be effective. I also think that a just and compassionate society has a responsibility to educate its population about what it takes to be successful in life. And one of the things that we know is that this path towards a healthy and stable marriage is crucial in success in our society. And for us to withhold that information seems ethically questionable to me. Even if we can't make a difference, we might argue that it's necessary. In addition, the other critique that I hear is that the government just needs to keep its nose out of this kind of personal business. But let me tell you that if you want the government to put its nose in your business, I suggest you have a child out of wedlock or get divorced. The government would be more than happy, and indeed is virtually required, to get deeply involved at a very personal level in how you run your family. It is family instability that is creating the demand for government to get involved. It's not like there are people who really want to, but they need to. The best thing we can do to keep government out of our personal and private business is to have a healthy and stable marriage. Then the government has very little involvement. And so if we want less government, we need stronger marriages. And given the cost that's involved to picking up the pieces of family instability, I think there's an argument to be made that government has an interest in trying to prevent some of those costs, as well as the psychological costs that come along with family instability. So that's my response to that one. There's another set of critiques out there. I hear it coming from various corners, but maybe comes a little bit more from the ideological left. And that is that healthy social and economic conditions are what's needed to support healthy, strong marriages. So policy should concentrate on those issues, improving social and economic conditions, good educational opportunities, job training programs, programs to help drug addicts get over their addictions so that they can be functional in these important relationships. These are the kinds of things that we need in order to strengthen marriages. We don't need to target marriages directly. Marriages will become strong when the social ecology in which they grow is healthy. Well, marriages do thrive in healthier socioeconomic conditions, in those more healthy marital ecologies, if you will. But I want to say, my response then is, first, this isn't either or. To me, this is both. We need both of those kinds of things. We need effective programs. We don't need ineffective programs. But we don't need to say either or. These programs are complementary, work well together with each other. Direct approaches to strengthening marriage, as well as creating a better kind of social ecology in which marriages can thrive. And why ignore a known factor of family instability, or a known factor of poverty, which is family instability? If we're about fighting poverty, and I hope we are, I don't know, it's hard to know if we're making progress on that sometimes, but it's certainly a concern that we have. Family instability is a known huge cause of poverty in our society. Why would we ignore that, is my question in response to this critique. Some would argue that we're subtracting funds from these other kinds of social policies, education policy, work policy that's needed. As I mentioned earlier, this is barely a drop in the bucket in terms of funding of social policy in our society. These are not funds. If I did the math and I, if we were to add all the funds that are supporting these healthy marriage initiatives to some of these other kinds of policies, we wouldn't even move the needle. It's less than 0.1% of what we're spending on other social policies. So this is a ruse to say that we're not, that this money ought to be used to for other kinds of policies. Well, I've listened to an argument that you need more funding for those kinds of things, but this isn't. These pockets aren't deep enough to help with that. And then I don't know, well, it looks like I'm just barely going to get a chance to talk about one final objection that's raised to these kinds of policies. Change is inevitable, and it's always occurring, but we can ride it to a better future. We're optimists, and this is what we do. We absorb change, and we ride it, and we take it to a better future in our society. There'll be a flourishing of many different family forms, more fluid family forms that work not by virtue of their structure, but by effective interpersonal processes and supportive contexts. And so we don't need a healthy marriage initiative. We just need to be patient, and we'll get through these hard transitional times that we're going through, and we'll find out how to make families work again. Is just the essence of that. If some of you know the social historian Stephanie Kuntz, she has been the primary spokesperson for this critique. I could tell you some fun stories there, but I don't have the time. Okay, so what's my response to this? When do we get to see the functional? We're now well into a second generation of high levels of family instability, and all the research continues to point in the same direction. It's hard on adults, it's hard on children. We're not finding that Shangri-La of these new family forms that are all going to work and make it and produce these optimal outcomes. It is still the case, 50 years after these, we've begun this tremendous trajectory upwards in terms of family instability. I guess we should say downwards, shouldn't we? That children growing up in a stable two-parent household have an enormous asset compared to those who don't. And we will soon be in a situation where the majority of children born in our society will not have that birthright of a stable two-parent family. When are we going to see the functional? I'm not as patient, I guess, as others are. By the way, it's all well and good, but what we're finding is that well-educated and well-off are making some of these new family forms work, but it's the not-so-well-off, the disadvantaged, that are really, really struggling with this. I think I'm going to stop there. We could talk about one further critique, but let me just end with my encouraging you to be more aware of these kinds of things, to be more supportive of them, to encourage our lawmakers and our policymakers to invest in these kinds of services that can help more children grow up with their birthright, a stable, loving home with both a mother and a father. We all want that, and I believe there's an agenda that we can adopt that will help move us quicker in that direction. Thank you for your attention.